Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 17 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm joined by my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
And this week, we have a special guest joining us remotely, our very first ever remote guest. Still within the family, it's my mom, also Jody, is joining us.
Hello.
And we invited her this week because we thought we'd talk a little bit about some topics related to schools and school reopenings, and Mom has a little bit of an insight into those topics. Why don't you explain a little bit of your who you are and your background and why we invited you, why we thought you'd be relevant to this conversation.
I've taught first grade for 30 years, both private and public school. Spent last spring doing it virtually. And because of all of this, unfortunately, I chose to retire.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. So we thought, you know, as a teacher, you'd bring some perspective. And of course, Jody and I both have school age children and their school district is navigating questions of what their school day should look like. So we all have some perspective. But I thought I'd start the conversation with a little bit of more of the data from the science, and we'll see where things go from there. So, you know, the general notion behind going back to school this fall with relation to the pandemic specifically is the idea that kids seem to get the get COVID-19 less frequently. And that observation seems to be holding. Younger children, especially, in the sort of under 10 group, seem to get sick less frequently than even older children and adults. That's not to say that they never do, and there are, there is the inflammatory syndrome that we mentioned previously that has shown up in some very young children. So it's not the case that no kids get sick, but statistically speaking, they're less likely to get sick. And there's been some thought that that also means that they are less likely to even get the infection or to be able to spread it to other people. And so they're less likely to be the source of outbreaks if we send them back to school, which would be in contrast to what normally happens during the respiratory illness season here in the United States, where once the kids go back to school, you can see in the data, for example, the data that we look at my job, you can see a pretty clear evidence that kids go back to school, infections of respiratory illnesses go up among children, and then a week or two later, the numbers in adults start to go up. And that's a pretty well understood phenomenon, specifically with the flu virus as well, that young children are a leading indicator of where the infection is going to be. But the thought was that, for whatever reason, the biology of the virus, the biology of children and so forth, that it might be different for kids this time around. But a couple of recent studies came out that raised some questions about this idea that they don't even get infected. One was published in the JAMA Pediatrics, JAMA being Journal of American Medical Association, looking at people in the Chicago area. They took a bunch of nasal swabs and they did, the PCR test that we've talked about before. One of the things we've discussed a little bit is that you can do that PCR test and actually count how many cycles of PCR you have to do before you get a detectable signal. And that gives you some notion of how much virus was in your sample to begin with. The sooner you get a signal, the less virus there was. The more virus there was because it took less amplification to get there into the signal. And so they looked at swabs from a number of people in different age groups. They filtered out people who were severely ill, who required like ventilation and so forth, because we know that severe illness is associated with high levels of virus. So they were looking at people with mild or moderate symptoms. And they found that children under 5 had took less time to get a signal, which meant they had more virus in their swab. or they at least had more viral RNA. There's the possibility, for whatever reason, that they have a lot of viral RNA, but not a lot of functional virus. But the simplest explanation for that is just that their bodies are making more viral particles than children over five and over, or adults. Even though they're not necessarily getting sick or severe illness, they're still shedding lots of virus. So that was the one study. The other study was published in the CDC's Emerging Infections Journal. It actually hasn't come out yet. It's what they call an early release. So it could be, there could still be some edits, but it's available online. And that was a study coming out of South Korea looking at contact between infections, the household contacts and the non-household contacts of people who were infected, and just kind of analyzing different patterns of transmission and so forth. And they found that household transmission was most common among households with what they called school-age children, which was their age group 10 to 19. There was transmission among, within all the age groups. It wasn't that that was the only group that was showing transmission, but that those households that had those children of those ages showed the most transmission between household contacts. And so both of these studies kind of suggest that even if they're not very sick, these children are still making virus and able to infect other people. So lots of caveats about the studies. They're not necessarily, randomized samples, because they're already selecting for people who gotten sick and who've come in for treatment and have come in for testing and so forth. There are already, some mitigation things going on, and schools weren't necessarily open in South Korea during this time. And so, it's not necessarily a picture of what would be the case, the number of contacts between kids and so forth, as it might look like during the school year, but it's some indication at least that kids are able to transmit the virus even without being seriously ill. So those were the two studies that came out that I thought would be worth mentioning. They're both pretty short papers. They're both freely accessible. And so they're probably might be worth taking a look at. The study designs are pretty simple, and so they're worth probably taking a look and getting a sense of, what a paper like this looks like and how the data is discussed and analyzed. The JAMA paper in particular would probably only be like 2 or 3 pages if you print it out. That's not to say that it's it has one figure. And that's not a criticism of the science. This kind of observational, straightforward studies in science is an important part of the scientific literature. But just an indication that, some papers take a lot of background to understand really what's going on, but these are pretty straightforward methods and results that are probably worth checking out. So that's a lot of me talking.
So I have a question about so what we're seeing is that the kids can shed, in the study, they're saying that little kids can shed the disease quite a bit, they're not necessarily symptomatic.
So they can detect virus or viral RNA. Strictly speaking, what they're detecting is a viral RNA. It is possible to get viral RNA without the fully formed virus. So maybe saying they're shedding virus might be a little bit strong in that case. For the South Korean study, there actually was transmission with older children. In that case, they're definitely making the virus and spreading it.
My question I did you with are, is that something that is somewhat unique to this virus, of it kind of impacting or showing up in children so much differently from adults? It definitely seems the trend has been the older you get, the more strong the symptoms are, and conversely, the younger you are, the more asymptomatic, or there's a question somewhere in there. I might not be sure what it was, but.
Yeah. So there, in general, there are a lot of age-related effects for infections and infectious diseases. So this virus is not unique in that regard. One another virus that has a similar pattern to this one of the older you get, the more severe the symptoms are, is the Epstein-Barr virus and mononucleosis. So in many countries and for much of history, mononucleosis isn't or wasn't really a disease that people got very often, because most people got exposed to the virus at a young age. And at a young age, you don't really get very many, if any, symptoms when you're infected. And so then you got exposed, you got immune. And so when you were a teenager or a young adult, you didn't get the virus again and develop some, you know, mononucleosis. In the developed world, with the advent of more hygiene practices and so forth, mononucleosis became a disease because we were not getting that viral infection naturally as children. And so if you got it as a teenager, you actually started to have symptoms. And that may have to do with the maturation of the immune response. It actually, the kids aren't responding as strongly to it. And so those symptoms are actually your body's reaction to the viral infection. And so because they're not reacting as strongly, they're not having the symptoms, but they're still reacting enough to be able to clear the infection and have memory for a future exposure. And that may very well be what's happening here with this virus as well, though that would be a hypothesis, not something that I can point to data that demonstrates it. So there's other instances where a similar kind of thing happens. And just in general, you know, we know that for a lot of diseases, age is a factor in how sick you're going to get, and even in some cases, how likely you are to pass it on.
So the studies would support not opening the schools.
So, you know, there's a lot of questions about that go in. There's a lot of factors that need to go into a policy decision like that. But it certainly doesn't support the idea that, well, we know that we can open schools because the kids are not likely to spread the virus. So I think if you are going to open schools, you are going to need to take mitigation seriously, especially depending on the levels of cases in that area. There are some parts of the country where the number of cases is still very low, or are now low. They were high and are now low, or they right. never really got high in the first place. And so I don't think at a national level, certainly not at a global level, we can say, oh, you definitely shouldn't open schools, or you definitely can open schools. I don't think it's unreasonable for some of these places with low levels of transmission to be considering opening schools. But it definitely suggests that mitigation is still necessary. Masks, cleaning, distancing, thinking, you know, to the extent that you can do things outdoors, all those mitigation techniques we were talking about, washing hands, coughing into your elbows, and so forth. Those are all going to still be important, and schools should be thinking about how to integrate those into their school day.
Now, I wonder if all this cleaning and wearing of masks will affect the flu season.
Yeah, that's something I've been wondering as well. It will be interesting to see if we have a more mild flu and sort of general respiratory illness season this winter, because we're already doing a lot of mitigation for the coronavirus, and those same mitigation steps will also reduce flu transmission and colds and all those things that we see in the wintertime.
Am I remembering in the spring, like back in like January, or well, I guess February, March, when you were looking at your data for work, I thought I remember you saying you were seeing less respiratory, or like there was this time, I think before COVID was really spreading, but maybe I'm misremembering.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a complicated question. At work, we get emergency department data. People stop going to the emergency departments in general. So lots of things fell off, including respiratory illness complaints. As I recall, the number of positive flu tests fell off pretty hard over the course of March. That's not entirely unexpected. You know, March is generally the tail end of the flu season. And that may also have to do with testing changes as well. you know, as there was greater focus on testing for COVID and so forth. Although I think there was still a lot of flu testing to rule out, to make sure that you were telling the difference between who had the flu and who had COVID-19. So it's a little bit hard to say, was that just the normal end of the flu season or what, but it did, it did look like at the very least, all these mitigation efforts weren't making the flu season worse, which would be surprising, but sometimes surprising things happen.
So by the children going back this fall, we may not have a resurgence of flu, and they might be able to stay longer in school than I had thought.
Maybe. The actual flu season, we talk about the flu season is sort of starting and the respiratory illness season is sort of starting with back to school. But positive flu tests really don't pick up until December or January. It's other respiratory illnesses that we're seeing. I mean, not to say that there's no flu, but the real kind of spike in flu cases comes later in December and January. There definitely are other respiratory illnesses that are associated with earlier in the fall. And yeah, that may not happen. These mitigation folks are diligent about mitigation, maybe less. It would also be great if more people were able to get the flu vaccine this season, because that would definitely help to cut down. It's not going to help with COVID-19 specifically, but it helps with other, it helps with the flu. And the fewer people that need hospitalization for the flu, the less of a burden there is overall in the healthcare system, so that we can help the people who have the most severe COVID illness.
So part of, when we were talking about, when we ourselves were having to make the decision about what we were going to do with our kids and, what was going to be the best options, considering what our district was offering, it occurred to us that, it's been 30 years since we've been in a classroom for a lot of parents our age and older. And, I happened to, help out in a kindergarten classroom last fall. And I know firsthand that kindergarten looks very different from what it did when I was in kindergarten, and even somewhat different from even what our middle schoolers were in kindergarten. And so, part of why we thought having Jody on would be helpful to talk about how the classroom has changed and how it poses unique challenges when trying to mitigate this virus.
Yeah, school is not Rose of Death anymore. When I was at school, the custodians were taking all the rugs out of the rooms. The children spent a fair amount of time sitting on a rug, moving around. Classrooms now, even as up as third, fourth, fifth grade, have beanbag chairs, toggle chairs, standing desks, sitting desks, and kids move from one to another. They don't sit at, many times they don't even sit at their own desk all day. They're all over the place. And you are now going to ask them to sit in a desk in their chair for, will be 2.5 hours, up to four, the middle school is going to be 5 hours at their desk, sitting there, 6 feet away from everybody else. We have not bought any kind of shields or anything, so they'll have to stay at their own desk. There is talk of letting them to go outside and do some things outside, because we're in a town where we have campuses and they can move around outside. Kindergarten, I've talked with the kindergarten teachers. They're concerned because they won't be able to play and interact with centers and things. We spend a lot of time with manipulatives, using hands-on things. How much of that we can give each child their own set depends on the resources that you have. But teacher does not stand up front and teach like we used to. And I have lost points in observations because they spend too much time on the rug. They have to be up and moving back and forth. That was the philosophy. They couldn't be anywhere in first grade more than 10 minutes. They had to be moving. You also have kids with IEPs who have special needs that need to go out of the room, that need to have special accommodations that are going to be a challenge with these parameters. I already had a parent contact us about sensory issues and dealing with the constant hand washing and the soap and sensitive to the cleaning products and all of that. It is a lot to think about.
I even think about, I don't know if Andy remembers some of our visits, even to the kids' middle school. They've had, with the big push of cooperational learning, they've gone so far as to, combine classrooms, removing cement wall partitions so that you can have two classes work together. And they created, a rug area with beanbag chairs and, mood lighting. So right. Just, it was a language arts classroom and just trying to make the kids, a comfortable homey type space where they could read and talk about what they're reading together. But like seeing how that's not possible to do safely.
No, so much of education now is more cooperative. Turn and talk to your neighbor. Turn and talk to the group. That cannot happen. You can't turn and talk to your neighbor when they're 6 feet apart. It's really going to change how teachers teach. It's more paper and pencil. I've thought about it. How do you get the kids to sit that long? They're going to have trouble because they haven't had to do that ever. It's just not how their schooling experience has been. You're going to have to let them get up and maybe do some jumping jacks every 15 minutes, 30 minutes. I don't know, just to get them to move some of the time.
And all these changes have to do with a better understanding of how kids that age learn, right? I mean, this exactly. Isn't just we want to make them feel better or feel less like school, but it really has, it's grounded in educational theory and understanding of how learning works and cognitive psychology and all that, right?
Right. Yeah. And there's a reason why we did all this and the value of talking to one another, the value of talking while you're learning. I would love it when someone would come into my room and they couldn't find me because I was on the rug with a group of kids doing something and kids were all over the room in little groups and with their clipboards and, meeting with a partner. It took a long time to get there, but when we would achieve it, I would be thrilled to see them all working independently. They were 6 years old, working with a partner. I could meet with a couple of kids and check in on their learning, talk about their reading, their math understanding. And you can't do that when they're all sitting at desks filling out papers. It's not the same kind of learning, but it's all you can do in that kind of setup. That I can imagine. I can't imagine how else you could do it.
Well, I know there's concern that it's going to be a lot of on screen with a lot of districts opting for a kind of hybrid model for the teachers to manage. They have to put content on a device so that those that are home can learn while those that are in class are also learning, and also minimizing how much pencil, paper, materials, that kind of stuff is being used, I'm sure.
Right. That's what they're doing with the older kids. But with the little kids, they'll be in class for 2.5 hours. And then the next group will come for 2.5 hours. They didn't feel they could handle the coming in for 2.5 hours or 3 hours virtually. So it will be in class, both sections mm-hmm. will be in class. But my fear is that we're going to do that for 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Then we're all going to go virtual. And if that happens, the districts, at least around me and where my friends teach, have invested a lot of time, money, and energy into getting the kids in the classroom and making that work. So you've had teachers take leave of absences. You've had teachers retire. So you're going to have to put in some new teachers. And then you're going to go virtual. And definitely not viral.
Well, I think we are a little viral if we're going virtual.
And they've invested nothing in improving the virtual experience in what I've been aware of. So it's not going to be a whole lot better than it was in the spring. Personally, because of my philosophy and liking to teach the way I did, I met with a lot of kids every day in small groups, in groups of three. And so we could do some sharing. We could do some, we could sort of model that small group way that we did in the classroom. Wasn't perfect, but we could create something like that. But it took me hours because when you're only doing three kids, I had to have six and seven groups meeting for 20 minutes a group, half an hour a group. You know, they actually only got 20 minutes, but I spent, you know, hours. So that's not ideal either.
As you were describing, you know, what your classroom looked like, or, you know, what your favorite moments were, you know, that sounded to me like that would actually translate better to an online setting than trying to do it in person, but with mitigation. But yeah, obviously having the kids up and moving around is possible at home, but then that means mom and dad or whomever is there at home needs to be more comfortable with that sort of thing. And there's less structure. And like say, you know, they're only even if it's taking your whole day, it's only 20 minutes at a time for the kids.
And we did make videos of us doing a math page using something called Screencastify. And we would give the directions. We would fill out the page and they would see it as we work through it. So we were sort of teaching them and they could do it along with us. We live I teach in a very unique town, and many of them were next door neighbors or a few houses away. So they would walk to each other's house and work together in the backyard at the, you know, a big picnic table or something, one kid at each end, and they would do some of the work together. It had its pluses and minuses. Most of our parents were working from home. It depended on the kid. If the kid would do the work, because it was spring, they understood the format of the papers. They knew what was expected. They could do it. It was first grade. Most of them were reading. The curriculum is set up now that the stories can be read to them. They can go online and have the stories read to them online if they have trouble reading a story. Beginning of the year, I think it will be much more challenging. You don't know your friends in your class as well. You don't know your teacher. The teacher doesn't know what her kids can and cannot do. And you're really building a foundation that we were able to work off of in the spring that they won't come in with, that will make it much more difficult to start the year that way.
Yeah, I think this school year is going to be very, very difficult, I think, for the entire school year. I know we all hope for this to wrap up quickly, and for there to be, you know, a vaccine quickly or things to get better. But I think we're still very much in the beginning or in the earlier parts of the course of this. And so kind of seeing how everybody needs to be flexible and think outside the box with a lot of, you know, I think about how our kids for the past several years, there's a lot of emphasis on teaching, you know, problem solving skills, you know, critical thinking skills, you know, coming up with solutions. You know, I think, you know, basically as a planet, I think we're all being asked to do this, you know, especially when it comes to educating kids this year.
And I think your kids, the kids in the district I teach in, they will be okay. But it's going to make that gap so much greater between the kids in less affluent districts who don't have the resources. Every kid I teach, who I taught last year, every child had their own device, not from the district, from their family, their own device that they worked off of, be it an iPad, a Chromebook. A couple of them got new Chromebooks because they saw what was coming, and so their parents bought them each a new Chromebook. None of my students had to go to the school and get a Chromebook, and they could have. There was plenty there for them, and some families may have had to, but none of mine did. And they all had their own device. They weren't sharing unless there was a glitch and they had to borrow mom's or something. They all had Wi-Fi. They all had the resources to do it online. That's not true for all kids.
Yeah, that's a very important point. Both the, like I say, the access to the devices and the access to the internet connection is varied widely across the country. And so, yeah, that's another reason why I don't want to say, going back to school is definitely not the right choice for all districts, because there are just realities that need to be reckoned with that vary substantially between these school districts. And providing the infrastructure for online education, unfortunately, may not be feasible. We could potentially make it feasible, right? I mean, that's one of the big differences. We talk about European countries that have been able to send their kids back to school, Southeast Asian countries that have been able to reopen schools. There's been more national support in terms of funding and resources to make sure that the schooling that they're going back to has what it needs for everybody to be successful as much as possible. I'm sure that Germany and South Korea and so forth have their differences in regions and so forth as well, but they don't seem to be quite as drastic, partly because we're just such a big country and our education is operated at a state level and a local level, and so there isn't a nationally unifying set of budgets or resources or approaches or philosophies and so forth. It's not to say that these are insurmountable challenges, but they are challenges that exist. They are differences and discrepancies that exist that will impact the results if we don't do something that mitigates them or levels them.
There's no easy answer. It's no simple solution. And until we go back, we won't know what happens. I think it's great that districts are offering options and parents who can stay home with their kids. I hear that some of them are taking that choice so that parents who have to send their kids can send them, and it's less, for the district to deal with in person, which I think helps.
It should, right? And anything that we can do, none of these mitigation things are absolutes. The virus, yes, the virus is here. No, the virus goes away. They're all statistical. They're all degrees. They're all matters of shades. And so anything that can help to reduce the number of interactions is going to help.
But how long will people agree to not hang out together? You can see that people don't want to do that. And kids want to be with their friends. And it's almost, and they've gone back in European countries, so I know it can be done, but it seems so hard that you put them in the room together, but you tell them they can't, intermingle. They have to stay at their seat. That's hard.
Yeah, I'm one of the things that we've talked about a lot at home as we've been making decisions is just like, yes, in the classroom, you have control over where they're sitting, but on the bus, like how do you control that? Yes, you can block off seats and say they're only sitting, but they have to follow those rules. And then getting off the bus. It's, I mean, we've all been on airplanes. We've seen people are not necessarily the most patient to wait to get off an airplane or get off any kind of transportation. Like getting, you know, not only, you know, little children, but even older children who should be able to understand procedures and stuff like that, I think is still going to be hugely challenging. Because they don't necessarily see the impact of what their decisions and actions, and that's part of the biology of their brains.
Yeah, I think the first few weeks, everybody is going to be really good at this. And then nobody gets sick, and it's all going well, and we all let our guard down a little bit. And, you know, and then, you know, well, the kids could, you know, maybe during snack time could kind of, you know, take off their masks, obviously, and talk closer. I don't know. But you could see where, as the time wears on, it's hard to keep up that level of, you know, strictness that they get off the bus in an orderly fashion, that they get on the bus in an orderly fashion, that they line up, that they don't share their supplies, that they, you know, on and on. It's a lot to think about and teach in between.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, not every interaction, not every time I talk to somebody, not every time we pass in the hallway, does that mean, oh, the virus has definitely spread between those two people? Because a lot of times neither one of them was sick. And so, right. Yeah, there's going to be lots of school days in lots of school districts and lots of buildings where nobody gets sick on any given day. And so the more of that you have, the harder it is to see the benefits of going through all of this stuff that is, right, as you say, genuinely costly, time consuming, mentally consuming. And so it is hard to see the value when the value is statistical. You know, we struggle with that in general. Right. In understanding, right, the value of things that are statistical rather than absolute, where I get a reward every time.
You're expecting a lot of those custodians. If a kid gets sick, if there's a sickness in a classroom, all eyes are going to be on that custodian that he didn't clean it well enough.
Yeah. And just even asking them to be at the front lines of doing the cleaning, right, and so forth, mm-hmm, and taking potentially a greater share of the risk of exposure themselves.
Well, right, we're seeing school districts that don't even have the staff to do that. So it's the teachers and teachers asking students to, you know, wipe down materials and desks and, you know, touchable surfaces. And I feel like that's a lot to put on a teacher. And I would have trouble feeling comfortable with a student being responsible for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, they're going to do a good job the first day.
Right. But then, you know, things happen. Something else that I haven't heard much talk about at all is, what about the teacher who just has to take a personal day or happens to have a migraine and can't come in? Where are we going to get subs? You don't want a lot of new people in and out. Are you going to get subs to come in? You don't want to combine classes. That defeats the whole purpose. In our district, we have a lot of aides, so we figure they'll put the aides in there. But do all districts have that? I don't know.
I know in our area, you know, aides can't be the only person in a classroom. You have to be a certified teacher to be in charge of a classroom. So that's not an option. And when they haven't had subs, what they do is they divide up. Like in the lower elementary classes, they divide up the extra class and everybody, right, gets five kids.
Yeah, but you can't do that when you're trying to keep down the numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, most, and again, because of the district I teach in, many of our subs are certified, many of our aides are certified teachers. So we can do that. If you only have one or two out, you can maybe cover them internally. It's another issue. And then you have all the related arts teachers. You have to figure out how to get them into the classroom. What does music look like when you can't sing? And what does gym look like when it's a rainy day?
Lots of music. It's going to be lots of clapping and rhythm. And
yep, that's what she said. And she was going to ask them to bring in like some percussion things. Because they'd all have to have their own. She would have to buy so many of them if she was going to.
Right. Well, then you've made it an art lesson, right? Because you can make a shaker, fill something with beads or buttons or whatever. Different kids can, and you can make it a science lesson too. Different kids put different things inside them. And what kind of sound does it make? Different amounts.
Right.
Now it's an art lesson and a science lesson and a music lesson. And you've provided the material, you know, you've provided the instruments so that the school doesn't have to.
Right. But it's definitely making everybody think outside the box. And
I'm wondering how the stress of all of this is going to impact. I know, you know, I've heard a lot of parents expressing the need to for the kids to go back to school for their, you know, mental health that the kids need to see. And I don't disagree with that. You know, we know that that's very important, but I wonder how the stress of it looking different and the stress of the first time you're being asked to quarantine because of an exposure, like how that is going to impact, especially, you know, kids that have, you know, kids that have difficulties with anxiety already, you know, and wanting to feel safe in a classroom.
I wonder how kids will feel exactly if someone gets sick in their classroom. If their teacher gets sick, did I do it? Did I make her sick? You know, him sick, her sick. I know how difficult it was because in our district, we lost a policeman and how the kids came on to Google Meets. They knew about it because the size of the town is so small. And we had to talk about it. And what did I want to do? Even with a screen, I just wanted to give him a hug. And I'm thinking, that's what you're going to want to do in person, and you can't. and yet everything in you, that's what you want to do. If they are upset or anxious or, you know, that's what you do. You give them a hug. You can't be involved with them in that way physically. But they are going to struggle because I saw them struggle in this with someone who they were not personally involved with. And it hit them, and it made it very real for them.
You also, you know, you mentioned the thought of a teacher having to take a sick day for a migraine or whatever. Even before we get to actual cases in the classroom, how do we deal with the logistics of, okay, that teacher is called in sick with a headache. You know, if it's generally a migraine and the person has a history of migraines or whatever, you know, it's likely what it is. But the symptoms of COVID-19 are so varied that, you know, do you think, okay, well, we need to think about whether that, you know, that classroom needs to be isolated until we get test results? Does that teacher have to go and get a test every time?
Whoa.
You know, or we're talking about cold seasons or whatever. Does every time a kid stays home from school because they have a cold, you know, do they have to get tested? Does the class have to get tested?
Right. Just taking your temperature when you walk in, to me, doesn't really.
You know, fever is a good indicator, but it's associated with a lot of cases eventually, but it's not often the first symptom.
Yeah.
And it's not always the symptom. And so, yeah, it doesn't touch the wide range of presentations of the illness. And so, yeah, you're not going to catch everybody just doing a temperature screen.
The best teachers are the ones who had it and had a mild case and now have the antibodies. They're in the best place.
Most likely, yeah.
But yeah, then there's the whole thing with testing. There's not enough testing for all the staff.
Right, and if you have to wait 4 days to get a test or four, you know, or a week to get a test and get the results, you can't have that many absences.
I did appreciate our superintendent made it very clear several times when he spoke making announcements to our district that it's like, nobody is going for perfect attendance this year. We are not giving that prize out.
He's a wise man.
I think that needs to be like a national. There is not going to be perfect attendance.
Yeah, I even had kids who didn't have perfect attendance with virtual, and they would email me and say, "I'm taking my kid's taking the day off. We need a personal day." But it's not easy, and I will say that the principals and superintendents have all aged with all of this, dealing with all of it. They don't want their faculty to get sick.
No, and I'm sure that many, many nights of sleep have been lost or cut short trying to deal with this. We have nothing but the greatest sympathy for everybody who's having to make these kinds of decisions. Personally, I think it's somewhat unfortunate that we are asking so much of so many people, that there's not more higher level guidance and leadership so that each individual school district and each individual superintendent and principal and so forth needs to make these decisions. Yes, there is local information that needs to be taken into account. At the same time, there are practices that are good practices, regardless of where you are, and there are decisions that need to be made at a higher level, so that all these different folks who never, who didn't sign up for this, who weren't trained for this, this was not the job
right.
that they have either the training or the experience for, to decide how to manage. They're essentially being asked to be something, some sort of hybrid of infection prevention nurse at a hospital and, public health epidemiologist and all of that. And that's not what they were trained to do. But this is the reality of the process that we're going through, and not just school personnel, but certainly including all of them, and including lots of other folks as well, that these decisions have just kind of trickled down to the lowest levels, to the point where even, parents are essentially having to make all these decisions, for the school districts. They're like, well, you can choose between an online option right. or a hybrid option or an in-person option and so forth, and, extracurricular activities and so forth. Now, parents who also did not sign up to be, epidemiologists and infection preventionists and so forth, are also having to weigh these decisions for themselves. If we can be of any help to anybody out there, we don't have all the answers, but certainly we'd be happy to support folks. And, that's part of what we're trying to do here, is help sift through the data, provide some data and some science perspective on this question. It's not that there's always a paper or data to answer every question, but certainly it's part of the conversation, and we'd be happy to add that part if it's helpful.
And to reiterate, this is a very nuanced situation, across the world, basically, specifically in, our country, depending on how different regions are having, but even like locally in just southwestern PA, where, the different areas have different levels of, cases, and it changes so drastically, week to week. It's definitely not something where any of us feel like we can say this is definitely what everybody has to do across the board.
Right. And unfortunately, they keep changing. They come out with one thing and say, this is what you're going to be doing. And then it changes. And, it makes it very, very difficult to plan. It makes it difficult to plan. You know what happened to your sister?
They had one plan. Are you saying that with the...
We're all going virtual. And it's happened here in Jersey. Towns that were going to be in person have now changed it and said they're going all virtual.
Yeah, it's changing here, district by district. We're seeing more boards are voting for virtual instead of hybrid. And
if they had done that, I wouldn't have retired. If they had made that decision at the beginning of the summer, And I think more towns will. And I think then you can spend the summer getting the virtual better. Now we've spent no energy on improving our virtual learning. And I fear that's where we're going to go. But I'm feeling optimistic when you say all this cleaning might keep down the flu too. So maybe we won't have as many illnesses as we normally do. It's just nobody knows.
Yep.
Just got to make the best decision that works for your family and your situation.
Yep. So being mindful of the time, maybe that's a good place to start wrapping up. Also, you know, since we're talking about timelines and the future and planning for the future, I thought it might make sense to just touch in again, since we've been kind of tracking vaccine progress. Since the last time we recorded an episode, two different vaccine candidates here in the United States have gone into the beginnings of their phase 3 clinical trials. So that's the largest and last step of the licensing process. It's where tens of thousands of volunteers get either the vaccine or a placebo, and neither they nor the person giving it knows which is which. And then they go about their lives as normal, and we look to see if there are more cases at all among the vaccine people versus the not vaccinated people or the placebo people. And we look to see if there's less severe illness among the people who do get illness. And we're looking to see, you know, both that the vaccine either reduces total number of cases or reduces the severity of the disease of those cases. And hopefully one or both of those will give us an answer in the positive. And, you know, the timeline for those is typically, I've seen 3 to 6 months as the timeline quoted in some different places. It really depends on how much infection is going around. And I think I've mentioned this before, it's sort of a perversely complicated situation where the more transmission is going on, the faster we can get an answer on these vaccine trials.
So the people involved in the vaccine trial now have to go out and not wear masks and not socially distance and not wash their hands?
So I don't think anybody's recommending that. Because that would be, because we don't know who has a placebo, and so we don't want to ask to engage in risks that they wouldn't otherwise be engaging in.
Go home and practice good things, none of them may get sick.
That is a complicated question. That is the issue. And that is why, you know, one of the reasons why you have to do tens of thousands of people is so that you can get some infections. You only have to get on the order of hundreds of infections among those tens of thousands of people to get an answer that is meaningful.
Oh, okay.
It's not like they all have to get sick or exposed to be able to get an answer. That's one of the reasons why you have to recruit so many people for those studies. And that's why we haven't talked about much on the podcast, but early on I mentioned that in general for these vaccine studies, they sometimes do what they call direct challenge studies, where instead of sending them out into the world to wait and see if they get infected, you get the vaccine, you come back a couple weeks later and you get the virus. Whether you got the vaccine or the placebo.
Whoa.
And yeah, we do that for some, we have done that in the past. We do that for some vaccines where we know that we can treat the disease if you do get it. But that's been the biggest concern about doing it for this virus is that we don't necessarily know that we can effectively treat people if they get ill. And we don't know for sure who's at risk for getting the most severe illness. And so that has been the reluctance to do that. The plus side of it is that, you know, these people are willingly volunteering for something. They know exactly what they're getting into. There are lots of people that have expressed willingness to do so. And we would get an answer much quicker with fewer people involved in the study. There have been several proposals to at least talk about it. As far as I know, nothing has moved forward. And on this timeline, it's probably not going to get us an answer quicker than these two trials will. Maybe for other vaccines, there might still be a chance to speed things up. Or if they really kind of accelerate it, and make a decision very quickly. They might be able to do so for these particular candidates, but so that's the timeline. For those two candidates who are already in the phase three trial, the Oxford vaccine over in the UK has also entered a phase three trial. Some others around the world are at that stage. We haven't seen the phase two results yet. Presumably somebody has, or they wouldn't have signed off on starting the phase three trials. But you know, publication process being what it is and so forth, the peer review and so forth, the wider public has not seen the phase two results for either of those vaccines. But we'll probably discuss those when they become available, and any other results. And as far as I know, we are also already manufacturing doses of both of those vaccines, so that if the answer from the phase three trial is yes, we can start giving them out. We don't have to then wait to try to manufacture them.
Right.
So that's kind of the where we are in that process and what the future timeline will look like.
Well, that's a happy note to end on.
I thought that was a good thing to try to wrap up on. Any other closing thoughts, questions, comments? All right. As always, folks have questions or comments for us, you can get in touch at BioBreakPod on Twitter or email biobreakpod@gmail.com. Or look for BioBreak on Facebook. And we will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.